kväll nummer 8 eller den 27 augusti 1981. Kväll med Rut Dennison Ljusbäck.
Night before yesterday, we talked about the fourth noble truth of the Buddha. Remember? It was the truth of his teachings, of his guidelines. But for us to walk, if we want to come to our high, to live our highest potential as a human being, that was the fourth noble truth. Tonight, I want to look with you into the other noble truth. There is the first one. Here and there we already mentioned, and especially the old students of Vipassana have heard or remember, that the first noble truth of the Buddhist enlightenment talks about suffering. In his language, it is dukkha. That is all that what is unsatisfactory, what is painful, what is bringing sorrow and suffering to us. I don't think we can deny this truth. There is really so much suffering in this world. Just this very moment, thousands, if not millions of people suffer just on very basic levels, have not enough food, have not enough medical care, have not care of beloved ones or close friends, are alone, have maybe not enough warmth, enough means to keep themselves warm. This very moment, so many people die. This very moment, so many people get born. All that is suffering. This very moment it is going on. We just need also to think of all those who are imprisoned right this moment, who suffer from brutality, from dominance of other people. Who suffer from ill treatment, who suffer in this imprisonment, perhaps that they are there for maybe no reason at all, for out of misunderstanding. It is so much suffering going on this moment. If we just allow ourselves to feel it. You see, the Buddha said, this all goes on, not because we create it, that we do too, but because the physical body itself is bringing this about. The suffering is within our body. Being born, being a human being, not being enlightened, lives in a condition which is ignorance, and which creates suffering. The human body is comprised, I think we mentioned, of all those elements which comprise the entire universe. And we are not quite aware of the enormous power of these elements, because there is a time of balance of these elements within ourselves, and after a while they follow their natural characteristic, and that is destruction, and of this we are not aware. And not really being aware of this causes us enormous suffering. So the seed of suffering is built in our constitution. The destruction which is inherent in our elements, we are not quite aware of it, and when it becomes apparent as we go along through sickness or through old age or through death, we are in great suffering. But there are other pains, other sufferings, those of the mind, the depression, the hatred we have, all forms of anger and aversion. The frustration, the sorrow, the unpleasantness we are feeling within ourselves. That daily deep feeling of boredom which we in which we suffer. That is a great completion in us, a great form of suffering. Also, don't we know how to handle it? also do we create more in through our unfolding. And it sometimes feels like we live like children in a house which is surrounded by fire. Children who play inside, being not aware of the danger. In this way, it feels sometimes that we human beings live, not being aware of basic of this destructive or inherent force of suffering. And so it is to know this and to look deeper into it is no need or is no use to pretend that suffering isn't there. It is there. We just need to look at it. We burn with anger, we burn with desire, and these fires in us create the suffering. That is the first, the truth of the first truth of Buddha's enlightenment. Suffering. Dukkha. But the Buddha didn't stand here still. He pointed straight out the cause of suffering. Just plainly did he call our attention that what binds us to this wheel of suffering or samsara is our bondage, our imprisonment in our own minds. Bondage is a kind of to take as attachment. On these force of attachment, this force of grasping and attaching, that is the cause of our suffering. And remember, it is said it is in our minds. It is not outside of us. Now let us see what kind of attachments are there. Four great attachments we should see. The first one is the one to sense pleasure. Always this seeking for fragmentary, for kind of momentary pleasures or good feelings. We are enormously attracted to this and enormously pulled by this force. Each of our senses is in constant action to satisfy this pulling force. So is the ear constantly out for good sounds. The tongue constantly directs itself toward delicious food. The eye constantly moves out for seeing nice things. The body is in constant craving for feeling good, for having pleasant feelings. It is an endless cycle or movement of wanting to have this desire gratified as soon as it arises. not knowing that the nature of this force of tanha, we can even call it tanha, that is that force which reaches out and attaches itself, is the nature of this force is not to be satisfied. So we are living by that a very a striving after momentary pleasures. We live for 1 week of holiday. We live and look forward for the next good relationship. We hope for another child. It might bring some happiness. We hope for a new flat. We are hoping for some change from outside constantly. And so we are waiting some living, I feel, in such a state, as so the happiness is just always a little bit out of our reach. Just a little bit. So we are always behind the real experience. To see this really, we may not feel we do that, but at closer a look and deeper understanding and observation of our mental activities, we will find that we belong to these kinds of unfolding too. Some have it more heavier and more obvious, crave and search after more greater things which are maybe more obvious. But on a finer level, the craving continues when we have stopped maybe a little bit the craving on the material levels. There is a nice story given, or an example, by a wise by the Sufis. The saint or the wise man Mullah Nasruddin, he had a way, through some comical action sometimes, to let us know how, or to demonstrate sometimes a particular tendency of ourselves. So Mullah Nasruddin goes to town and sees very good looking green peppers, or red peppers, the little long ones, and he buys quite a bunch of them and goes home and sits down in his place and begins to eat one after the other. And as he proceeds, the tears out of his eyes are streaming. His nose is distorting in different shape. Out of his mouth, it is running the saliva because of the sharpness of the taste of these peppers. There comes the student and says, "Oh, hello, Mula, what are you doing? Why are you eating all these?" He said, "Well, I am waiting for a sweet one." So, that's the answer. The second attachment of which keeps us to the round of samsara, which is the cause of our suffering is the attachment and the craving for the insistence to what we may say our ideas and our views. When we are filled with our own ideas, which are mixed and conditioned, not clear wisdom energy, every of our experience and everything we hear, we are receiving through these conditionings. So that is to say, everything what comes in as our experience gets filtered and colored by these glasses of conditioning. So then we have new ideas, not clear ones, not wisdom ideas. And then we add more and we collect more, because the force of attachment, the force of desire is accumulating. So we continue accumulating ideas, and then the force of attachment does not let them go. We have them. They have us at the time, at the end. So that, of course, keeps us from really seeing how things are, how simple they are, how pure they are, how real, how factual. There is a very famous great master in Thailand who was asked by one of his students, or maybe who had many Western students. He was asked, what feature did you observe, especially with your Western students? And he said, well, their greatest obstacle and their greatest feature and strongest tendency is holding on to their own ideas, asserting them, insisting to push them through as though they were the truth. That constant asserting of their ideas is, he said, what keeps them away from really trusting and losing their doubts, of really letting themselves fall into the chance of experiencing. It is like, you see, like a cup in which there is stale water, old water, or a container. And in order to use this container, we would have to empty it from the old water. Unless we empty it, it is not useful for anything else. In the same way, unless we empty our minds from all conditioned ideas, it is not useful. It is not a useful tool for coming to the last evolution of yourself, coming to realize yourself. We will tie ourselves closer to ignorance in this way. And the third attachment as a reason for our suffering is that belief that rituals, ceremonies, reading or wreaths will bring a change about in me, will come to my, will bring me to wisdom and to maybe realize myself. That can go so far that we are even taking the practice as something to attach ourselves to it and make it a very righteous and special thing. So strong, and I see it again and again this happening, can we attach ourselves to the preciousness of the practice or the technique that we forget to practice it, that it becomes an idea in our head. No, some rituals may be nice if you have the right attitude to it, if you take it as an enhancement to my atmosphere, as a reminder for for my practice, as an attraction for my practice or an assistant. But if we take these symbols of this or the ceremonies, burning an incense and lighting the candles and building an altar as a thing in itself, as so that is a thing which will lead me to self-knowledge, is wrong, is an attachment, and keeps us away from the real unfolding here, keeps us in our ignorance, in our bondage of attachment. Now the fourth attachment is one of the very subtle nature, however it is the most deep, deepest conditioned one. That is that belief that there in us is living an entity or something, an I, or if a me, some factor which is permanent and which governs this whole thing, this mind-body process. That is to say, it is this fourth attachment is the absence of the knowledge that this is a mind process which is in constant flux, interacting, where there is no entity governing the whole thing. And because of this absence of this knowledge, we are that there is no entity, no permanent faculty in us who determines everything. We are getting involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions. We get involved to these deeds of to these unwholesome deeds in such a way where we are motivated and pushed by greed and by hatred. This greed and hatred and the delusion, the ignorance, are the three roots of all unwholesome, immoral actions. And when there is no knowledge and no understanding and awareness, we are mostly governed by these forces of the mind. Yeah, this attachment to this idea of I is so strong that we lead a life where we have totally everything related to this ego-centered, to this I center, and begin when it becomes so strong that we begin to isolate ourselves from the world around us. That is another way of tying ourselves deeper to the ignorance and to that mass of pain. Very unfortunate is that people don't know, I would say, if they would know, that the widening of the heart and the breaking through this ego-centeredness in ourselves, the loosening of these attachments, really reduce our suffering, weaken these states of pain and sorrow, of depression and whatever we may call it. It's hard to see that, but it really is so. Then the second noble truth. So this is the second noble truth of Buddha's enlightenment, the cause of suffering, attachment. Four forms of attachment. The attachment to sense desire, the attachment to the practice itself, to the forms and rituals, the attachment to the ideas and views, and the attachment to the belief of self. And to realize that there is nothing here outside of us which does this attachment bring about is important, is perhaps the thing which would loosen us from this attachment, just to realize it, that the force of this attachment is within us. Actually, we are that because of of this constitution we are. There is a good example given in the scriptures, I recall, of to demonstrate this force of attachment. There is a monkey trap in form of a coconut, of the outer shell, and it is fastened, and there is one slit made, and big enough to let the hand of the monkey, the open hand, go through, but it is not big enough to pull a fist back, a closed hand. So when the monkey comes and smells the sweet item, the sweet food in that coconut, he naturally, by the force of desire, reaches into it. He is that clever. But he is not that smart to bring it back, because the force of desire and the force of attachment to the food, to the object of desire, hold him now in prison, because he doesn't realize now, when he pulls back, he doesn't realize that. And he is so attached to the food in his hand that he stays a prisoner. And when the hunters come, or the catchers come, he gets excited, he probably is in tremendous fear and panic, but he cannot get loose, he cannot let go. And so he becomes a prisoner. They catch him. Would he know that if he would have, he just needs to open the hand and let go of the desired item, he could let his hand, lead his hand through the slit and be free. So what keeps him in? The force of attachment, the force of desire. And where is it? In himself. What would he need to become free? The realization of it. In the same way to us. If we realize that deeply, we would not insist on my depression. We would not hang on to the states of suffering. That doesn't mean we turn the back and don't attend to it at all or run away. No, it's just the quality of attitude. We see it. It is there. We recognize it, but we don't identify and make it something which belongs to me, which is me. So if you find yourself in future in such forms of attachment, think of the foolish monkey. You are in that moment the same one. The force of attachment holds us. So I think we can go to the third truth of Buddha's enlightenment, the end of suffering. That is the truth who tells us there is an end. We don't need to suffer. We don't need to lead a life in this bondage, which prevents us to really realize ourselves. There is a possibility. And that is a state of nirvana. And that is a state which lies beyond mind-body process. That is to say, it is beyond pain. It is such a realized mind, such a great mind, which sees it all but is not affected by it all, at all. That then there is in that mind, there is a cool, there is a peace, there is a release. There is no question, there is no upset. It is the mind of total understanding, the mind which has put down the burden, which is not attached. And that's nice for us, perhaps, to see, to differentiate, or to think of two kinds of nibbana, of realizing, realized state, unconditioned state. The first one is a sort of momentary nibbana. That is the freedom, the burdenless, or the freedom from hatred and from anger, from greed, from defilement. That is what can, however, happen each moment when we are able to let this burden down. It's a momentary enlightenment. where we are free from all these attachments, where the fires in the mind are put out from moment to moment. Just think of your practice this afternoon, where we were experiencing with the help of movement, with the help of concentration and attentiveness. There were moments where you were free from all that, where there was a lightness, where was no bother, where you were maybe even feeling that you could accept everything as it is, where you were in right state of mind, where you could solve your problems in a cool and in an objective way, without even seeing it perhaps as a problem. So every moment of such freedom is a moment of enlightenment, is a moment of cool, is a moment of peace. And that's why this practice is so wonderful. It allows us to give us a little taste for a second, sometimes for a little longer, on different levels, or different maybe degrees of freedom are there to maybe to see too. But this practice does give us this. We don't need to wait and to just drive through and practice hard and gloomy. And just wait until someone, someday, there will come our relief. Until then, little reliefs come each moment. The delight of the concentrated mind can be experienced from moment to moment. Now, the other nibbana, the second nibbana, that has not the quality of change anymore. It is not a temporary, a momentary release. That is a release from all which is steady, which is beyond the mind-body process altogether. It is the total ending of our suffering, of our bondage, of our enclosure, and it doesn't change anymore. It is constant. You don't go back and forth. You don't need to work toward it. It is a mind which is constant, all embracing whatever is there, without the ties of attachment, without the ties of involvement, with total clarity, with all-embracing compassion and understanding. This third noble truth is the experience indicated by the Buddha when he simply says that there is no higher happiness than peace of mind. Very simply said, it is the end of suffering, of our dissatisfaction, of our striving. Now, the fourth noble truth is the way. And it is the way we were speaking about the other day. That is the path of balance. It is the guidance for the practice to cut loose from this wheel of samsara, to cut loose from the condition of suffering, from the we recognize the cause of suffering, is middle path. It's a path, a guidance between the extremes. It's a path which deals with reality, which is not based on belief, which is not based on any miracles. It is just a very plain, natural unfolding, which is, as it unfolds, or as we practice, a tremendous enrichment and enhancement of our lives. In fact, it becomes the natural unfolding, our life. That's why it is called middle path. So the first noble truth, the truth of Buddha's enlightenment, dukkha, about the unsatisfactoriness of the condition of life, has to be realized. Now, we may all say, yes, sure, I know that, but not deep enough, not really deep enough, where we come to really understand within our mind-body process, yeah, there in these interactions, in these energies, are contained the condition of suffering. So it has to be realized very deeply, the first noble truth. And the second one, of the course, has to be understood. And each time we are hearing it, each time we are practicing, we understand a little bit more of this force of attachment, of tanha. We begin to understand it. Only be experienced through walking the way of the fourth noble truth, or the guideline. So the first one realized, the second, the course understood, the third has to be experienced, and the fourth has to be walked. We have to realize that we have to do this. The Buddha was enlightened. He saw everything. But his enlightenment does not solve our ignorance and our problems. We can, we have to go into this process and do it by ourselves and follow the invitation he gives us, which is the fourth noble truth. These four noble truths, when you begin to study or to read a little about Buddhism or the scriptures of the Buddha, they appear again and again and again. They are actually the heart of the of Buddhism. They are the core of it. All other things we are reading are only the explanations. So I think that is enough. We could talk a lot more about these. Sometimes I take time to talk only about one of the truths the whole evening. But I think because our time runs out in a short way, I tried to, in a shorter way, to give you an idea of the content of each of these truths. Perhaps we could see them as a sequence, as a unit of four different of sequences, and one is leading to the other. It isn't just the first noble truth and the third noble truth. It is a completed unit That is to say, you could not add a fifth one, or you could take one out. Why? Because the first one is saying the condition, describing and telling us the facts of life, dukkha. The second is telling us plainly the cause of this dukkha, the cause, the next sequence. The third says, there is an out of it. And the fourth is now saying, you have a guidance for this. Here is the way how to do it. Now that is why we couldn't have a fifth one. It's not necessary anymore. These four are giving the complete, is are a complete unit. You see? So perhaps you have a question. Yes, Richard.
One of the Buddhist truths is about anicca, that all things change.
Yeah, well, that is suffering. That's the first noble truth.
And
belongs to the first noble one, because change is also a cause for the suffering. Change is suffering. The change, the impermanence is suffering.
But is
you can see, yeah, that appears in a different. Let's see. You can explain it in a different way, the Buddha's teaching. That it, no, that's not anymore the teaching. It's maybe we can see it as the three essentials of the Buddha's teaching. He taught of impermanence, he taught of suffering, and he taught the law of no self. You see, but all are actually, all what it is saying is, because it's a condition, and because of that, they are suffering.
But my actual question, I have not put yet.
Okay.
But,
you haven't? Well, why don't you?
Because I wait.
Good.
How can the state of nirvana be also not subject for change?
Because it is the end of suffering.
But then everything is not changing.
Oh yes, it is still changing. Only your mind isn't changing anymore. You are steadying, receiving all the events. You see so clear, constantly change, arising and falling out of existence. And what sees and what is viewing it is constant. That is the nibbanic mind. You see?
What about the four truths?
That
they don't change time.
Say it again.
About the four noble truths.
The last one.
Yeah, do they change one constant?
They are just the fourth one. Yeah, they are also subject to change. They are actually a description. The number one is a description of the condition. The condition constantly changes. Yes.
But not the truth.
No.
Because then it could be different.
Yeah, the truth does not, and the truth is actually the seeing of that. The mind which is so steady in understanding that, is so steady of clearly seeing that there is nothing but change. Each second is a consciousness arising. Each moment millions of thoughts are running through. On the material world, constantly changes occurring, arising and passing away. Eyes constantly see change. Everything changes. So it is not that the outside is steady in the Nibbanic state. That is a change. All phenomena are subject to change. That means they also, the destructiveness is in them. Out of that, something else will develop.
But
the mind which sees that, and the body which is experiencing the change, actually it's out of that, is steady. That consciousness which is receiving these messages and seeing the condition, seeing the cause, is no subject to change. It is a wide mind which has transcended and it's broken through that mind which is working through this senses, through the identification of I. It's hard to understand that. Very hard. Yes, Sugata.
I have got the explanation that Nirvana is the unification with the universe, with the absolute. That means the returning of the I to the God.
That is in a Christian term. Very good said, yeah.
And a Brahmin, a very old Brahmin, spoke with me once, and in the middle of one setting, he mm-hmm. was putting in something, and he said, look, a river has a name and shore and direction.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes to the sea, he loses shore and name and direction, and that is Nirvana. Yeah. That is, in other mm-hmm. words, we lose the Gebundenheit, what is this in English?
Limitation
by space and time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are always bound by space and time, but when we lose this limitation by space and time, then we come, then is Nirvana reached. The ego, the personality disappears completely.
Yeah, but it really has no value in too much thinking about it, because the conditioned mind can really not grasp it, and can just build another condition with it. I think just keeping open the mind, which is not clinging to the experiences, and is constant and training itself constantly to be alert and to be witness of the arising and the passing away of events, of feelings, of consciousness, of depression, of my ideas, of my all forms of suffering, all forms of unfolding. You are a kind of imitating or putting efforts a little toward the little enlightened mind, because that is the quality of it, that it doesn't react, that it doesn't have any connection, what you said, any bezug, any attachment to I. It is just in great alertness and recognizing always what is happening. Now that sounds very frightening for some conditioned mind, because they say, well, then I don't experience anything more, I cannot feel any, and I cannot care anymore, and just shall be detached from everything. That's not so. You see, if you can observe in an alertness, where you have no ideas of, or you are filled with your own feelings, you are with an open mind and open heart looking at what is happening, you are free actually to really participate if you needed to participate. You are also free to decide now rightly whether you want to participate in that event, whether you want to become repressed and sad when the sadness is arising. Or you have, and you also have the choice to really to say no, to let it pass by. It's subject to impermanence. It will change. And in the strength and in the acceptance and in the non-involvement of your observing mind, it changes, it vibrates what is there, the depression, the sadness, the greed, the hate, and before you know, you are free from it again. It passed by, and what remains is the mind which can see that, cool, calm, harmonious, see? So you are kind of, that is the, meant by momentary Nibbana, momentary big mind. Christian terms, you can say momentary unification, or momentary closeness to God. Okay, all kinds of names you could give it. But what is important to see is, for what it stands, in both cases the same, that there is a mind, whether you call it God or the empty mind or the big mind or the Buddha mind, who is just so clear, so empty here, that it really can take in what is coming up and can observe and has the graciousness and the patience to let it go by too. And you will, in that you will see that what is rising and what is passing by, it's nothing but your own living process. So again, you live with this process like it is in the light of and the tenderness and the all-embracing attention of your mind. And I think in that way, it's it is a great incentive for us, or a great reason, perhaps, to really practice this. It's an attraction, actually, if you understand the process. A very natural attraction to constantly provide in myself a little enlightened mind, a burdenless mind. But that doesn't mean not caring. It's a caring mind. It's a tremendous loving mind. Because when you take out all these if you are not attached to this creating process in here, then you are which is actually all unwholesomeness, all what is giving us trouble. And if you're not attached to that, then what is there is really the mind which is open and loving and caring. It's nice. It's worthwhile doing it. Well, we actually do it. All day long we are on it. This afternoon we had a wonderful session, remember? That's what we are practicing. Becoming freed from these attachments. Attachment is not such a good word, but that's what we have. Tanha. Yes.
But in this Buddha teaching is also given a clear way, the Eightfold Path. And there's spoken about this dream winner, the seven times returner, the once returner, and the never returner. That means the process to come to nirvana is a long process of wish to leave this life of change. And in this process, it is called Ayapugala, are given very clear determinations how to do. And it is really a wish to pay the old debts of karma and not to be involved in new debts of karma. Is it not like that?
Yeah, but that's quite complicated, Sugata.
It is
really
complicated, but
yeah.
It is very clear,
yeah,
given in the Buddha teaching.
Yeah.
And in no other teaching is there given a way,
yeah,
of that kind.
But that, yes, I think
not
that...
Not in Christianity.
No. Well, I think in some of the teachings of Christianity, the old teachings, which was... probably the contemplative practices they had in the monasteries. They,
in Christian monasteries?
Yeah, they have also brought about saints and enlightened people. So there must be... they also... you can also go probably through these rules and invitations from... which Christianity has. But I think what you want to say is that the clearest way for the for enlightenment, I think, is the Buddha's teaching. And in no other teaching comes so clear this teaching of anatta, of no self, which brings really it down to the, which is actually the essential of all religious teachings, that the no self, the I, has to subside. In Christian terms, it says, I have to become. How do they say it? The Father and I am one, says Meister Eckhart. You see, there is the high goal of the Holy Ghost and the Father and the Son. All three are one. Or the Holy Ghost, I would think, could be the enlightened mind. The Father could probably be the I wouldn't know, but the Son is me. It's
so
personal
God. And
yeah.
Buddhism, you have a perception of an unpersonal
right.
God.
But Sugata, the personal God, it sounds like one, but the real enlightened people in the Christian Christian tradition have seen that God and
I met any
are one.
Christian?
Well, I would
you
say.
You have met many.
Yeah, well, but there have been some. I would say, I don't think one can say that statement so categorical, because Meister Eckhart was an enlightened person, and I think so was St. John on the Cross, and so was Teresa of Avila, and but only that they speak in Christian terms. I think we have to to see what the terms are standing for, what they are representing. Absolutely, I do believe that the Meister Eckhart's term, the Godhead and I am one, means that the Godhead is the enlightened mind, and I am one, that means I am not existing.
But was he
I am the river which has
Platonica.
Come into the ocean.
Was he not a new Platonic, and was not his scriptures, were not his scriptures forbidden afterwards?
Well, that is something else. That is because the church had had doubts, did see him as somebody who is fallen. You see, they didn't understand. Well, so others. It's true, there's lots of confusion. But I don't think this is a place to discuss that more. That leads into endlessness. What concerns us is that we are here in a practice which is very clear guidance, which is very directed toward the mind, toward developing the spiritual aspect of our being, but not outside of our daily life, but that it is really life itself, and that it is useful for my life, this moment. It's not useful. We are talking about the enlightened people in the Christian tradition, or even in the about the enlightened people in the Buddhist tradition. It has no direct use for me. I cannot cannot deal with that. But the path, the Eightfold Path, the guidance we have here, I can deal with. I can use it as my guidance for developing my spiritual nature, my deeper self, my potential, the seat of enlightenment, can come to grow, to penetrate me, can become, come to its full fruit when I follow this way. And I try it here, and try every moment, tireless with you, to give you a taste of that. And I think that is the beauty of the teaching. There have been many other beautiful teachings, but I think this is a very clear way, and a sort of scientific way. You observe, you see the result, and you have out of that result the guidance for the next, and you go on. That is the beauty of it. And take what you can get, and for what you can, you be open. And be respectful, and open to other ways, but be observing, employ the same principle to everything, the objective mind, and then you don't, you are in a space where you see for what it is. It all has its purpose, it all has its good, but there are differences, differentiations or degrees. Some ways are more direct, some lead around with side roads and so on, and come later to the goal, and some may never come to the goal because they are so far branched out, the roads leading to it. And I see the beauty of this teaching, and I am tremendously appreciative of it. Also attracted by it, and wholeheartedly I follow the Eightfold Path. Through that I understand many other pathways quite well. And in many ways the Eightfold Path crosses or has parallels to other teachings, but still this is a very, very clear one. Yeah.
You spoke one night about the four skandhas.
Yeah.
And as I understand it...
Five
skandhas?
Yes. Four mental and one physical.
Mm.
The body, the feeling, perception, consciousness, and mental formation. Yeah.
As I understand it, the state of nirvana has to do with the mental formations.
No, not anymore. It's out of it.
Yeah, but then it has to do with it.
Yeah, yes, it has to do.
I mean, because that is what is changed, you know. From the samsara mind.
Well, the mental formations is the samsara mind,
so
to speak.
There are no mental formations at all.
The person who is enlightened can still think. There are forming mental formations, but the difference is that what forms there has no ties. And it only forms when it is necessary. He is otherwise free from all these burden here. He falls into its own energies, also into the non-burdened consciousness. So he is always in to the great presence. Well, I can say I think I have met two enlightened people. None of them claims he is enlightened, but everyone, both of them say that, well, one is a real rascal. He says, well, there is nobody there when I go to sleep. There is no one laying between the sheets. And he sleeps 4 hours, very steady. He does a normal way of life. He will not talk unnecessarily. He will answer you the questions, and he will always throw it back to you and tell you how dishonest you are. then how you cling to things. He will describe always the state where you are in, so that you have a mirror, that's all. Because what, but very accurately. He is more, you know, Yukata, I would put him into the category of Pacheka Buddha. Have you ever gone?
Yes, Pacheka Buddha.
It doesn't teach. He does not teach.
There
like the Buddha.
Buddhas,
yeah.
The Bodhisattva.
Yeah, Bodhisattva, who teaches. The enlightened one does teach also. But the Pacheka Buddha does not.
He's found his
own silent.
Out, heaven cubits,
yeah. Yeah, but yet just his presence does teach in a way.
His presence.
A, his presence. And it's a very normal presence.
For the atmosphere.
Yeah, right.
May I say something about Bodhisattva and Arhat also?
Yeah.
Because there are two ideals in Buddhism. The one is the Arhat ideal, that is the somebody who strives for nirvana and is completely elitaire. That means he cuts all connections with his surroundings, and he's mostly on a high mountain and meditates on it.
Arhat.
The Arhat.
Yeah.
The Arhat. And the Bodhisattva is helping people. He is renouncing his own nirvana for to help others to develop.
He holds it back and teaches tirelessly.
Yes. And you have the same ideas in Christianity. You have the Madonna, which is not doing anything. She is only developing her own, she's lightening. And she gives she's only working by her example. He who's ace can see this example and be inspired by it and,
mm-hmm.
and follow it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Christian ideal of Christus is helping people by actions.
Yeah.
So you have both these ideals which you have in Christianity, also in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. That's very nice. Aspect you brought up. Yeah, the Madonna just fills the space with her presence of love and positive energies, compassion.
By her example.
Yeah, by her example. And Christus teaches, like the Bodhisattva.
And in this beautiful book of Hermann Hesse, Das Glasperlenspiel, it is translated to Swedish now. There are also two chapters about two monks in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know of each other, and one is always listening to the people, and then he says, "Oh, we will come to heaven," and so on. And he's shouting and everything. And the other monk is just listening and says nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end he's blessing the people and
mm-hmm.
they go away. And after 25 years the one thinks, oh, I'm just only blessing and people go away, that is meaningless. I must go to the other fellow who shouts. He is the right man. And he who shouts, he thinks, oh, I'm shouting and shouting, people are going away, and he doesn't help. So I must go to this other monk, which is just blessing the people. He has the right way. And so these two meet. That's a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm. What happens when they meet?
What?
What happens when they meet?
When they meet, they slowly come to an oasis, both from, one from west and the other from east. And so slowly they say, oh, you're also a monk? Yes, yes, I'm a monk. Have you heard about somebody who is in a cave some days from here? Yes, yes, I know him. So slowly they come together.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end they live together also.
Yeah.
This is symbolic about these two ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's also probably also a lot of imagination and of wonders and so on about the enlightened state. And when one finds a person who somehow is and he actually acts in a normal way, what is different is actually only his attitude, his relatedness to the world and himself. I think of this old man in India. Everyone says he is enlightened, he is a Brahmin, but has practiced the method of attention, was a Buddhist, kind of Buddhist teacher he had. By the way, all what he said and what he spoke is written down in a book called I Am That. If you ever get that, or I send it to you, I think you have two copies.
Oh.
Yeah. The one who he does not speak English, he speaks only Hindu. And the one who did write the book was a non-Hindu and spoke English and Hindu, and he just always let the tape recorder go. And so he translated that, and it is now published in a book. I got even one of the first copies when I was in India. Now I see it translated into German even. So very simple ways he will just speak or talk when you will say something or question. He will just always bring back to your attention that you are, that we are projecting and motivated by greed and attachment, and that this is not the fact of himself. He is freed from all these motivations and rests in, I don't know how he expresses, I rest, it doesn't say the great mind, I rest, maybe I think ground of being, I wouldn't say what he said, he rests there. And when I speak, Iris, I am not answering you. It is a response which was brought about by you. Understand that?
Mm.
Yes. It's you to whatever you said, it is resounding here, and there is no I and no self who does answer. What? It's like a mirror. It falls back, you see? Yeah. It's a response. So, I was very excited when I heard about it. So I asked Dr. Friedman, who was the one who does the recording, whom I knew, through whom I did actually go there. Had an appointment at 9 o'clock in the morning. And when one goes to such a person or a bodhisattva, the tradition is to bring a present or to bring fruit or flowers or maybe something else. Presents, dana. So I had a rickshaw, I think, or a horse carriage, I don't know. Yes, a horse carriage. Wanted to go and meditate and wanted to be so special to go to him. I didn't want to be touched by impurities, and so I took a carriage. I was secure, so to all those masses of people, crowds of people in Bombay, in the streets. And this was so early in the morning, all these market people come and scream and push, and oh, it's tremendous. So I wanted to have a carriage. And so I sit there and I go into myself, it was 10 or 12 years ago. And so I stop at the marketplace to get some fruit. I couldn't decide quite which one. Never I found the right one till I realized what I was doing. So I just bought beautiful mangoes, a big basket full, bought a basket and fruit, and put flowers on top of it. Big thing. Then I came, but I was attached. Apparently I was too long in it because I was late. Well, I thought, doesn't matter, I bring such beautiful things. So I come there, and very ordinary house, actually in the slum area where he lives. And go in, stone floor, and through one dark corridor and to another one, then I come to a dark room which has a little slit only as a door, as a window. And there are a few beds, we call it, two children sleeping. And then a young woman comes and says, yeah, up there is the Maharaj. I go up, it's a ladder, simple ladder. Ladder. I thought, you know, temple. I thought, an enlightened person, full of light and silver. And what, I don't know what was in my head. So, a ladder. Go up. And the room was a partition. The floor was a partition of a high room. And there he was on the second floor. That was the second floor. A beautiful, spacious room like this. There's a wonderful big altar. I think it was all silver. And a bed in one corner with beautiful, all kind of blue and pink. Silks were his pillows. They looked like a couch. And then he was sitting on the window. Now you see, because these were big windows and the partition, so the windows went to the floor. Here was the floor. And now he was sitting here. Right, I remember it was this way. And down below were the marketplace calling, and all the language was going on there. And he looked there and sat. And I just sat there. So I come and prostrate, and three times before him. And he just put his hand out and, I don't know, gesture of blessing. And then he said, he doesn't speak the language. I didn't speak a language. We had no common language. But then I couldn't wait for anything. So after a while, I closed my eyes and was sitting. I said, something is going to happen. And maybe three quarter of an hour later, came a gentleman, one of his disciples, prostrated, went to the altar, burned an incense. And he was so sitting there smiling. He was like butter. So kind of soft and smiling. And sometimes nodding. And then he looked down again. Very tender and loving. And then this gentleman came, and he spoke English. So he began to speak. And I don't recall anything really much what he said. I had, I think, not many questions. He only asks when you say something when you ask. But I recall one thing which really became a wonderful guidance for me and a great insight. He said, you must become, I think I asked him something about my meditation. He said, you must become aware of awareness. So that was perhaps, that was then, but so you know, just that was translated. And then, after a while, they both were talking. And then he turns to me, the interpreter, and says, the Maharaj asks you why you were late this morning. See? Enlightenment becomes very accurate, very carefully observing the facts. So, my big basket of beautiful fruit had no way, had no meaning, did not apologize for being late. He hardly took notice of it. Yeah, he can't, because there's no self, you see. He sees it, he knows for what it is. Someone will come and use it for food. He couldn't use them all.
But did you know how many baskets he gets every day?
No.
Maybe he gets 10.
Well, he gets probably
a lot.
There's
more than one visitor.
Oh, yes. There were, at 5 o'clock, I sat all day long with him. And at 5 o'clock, there came a lot of students, people.
And everybody was
very devoted. People, you could see they were businessmen, they were older people, they were young hippies. During the day, a lot of Western hippies came too. Western, I call them hippies because they look like that. But I don't hold to the concept, it's just there. They came then, and then Aya. And then he, after they were sitting there and meditating, and he did not say a thing to them even. Once in a while, but there was such a, you know, it was almost like he wasn't there, and yet he was there. Then he got up and he took bells, this kind of bell I think he did one, and he had a wonderful rhythm. He was this kind of thing, and somebody else, and they made a wonderful ceremony, a puja for their deities, and lit the candles on the altar. And then one of the hippies, daringly, with lots of ideas and views, said, why do you do that if one shouldn't be attached to it? Yeah, it's a good question, you see, he couldn't understand that. And you know, he said, for you, you should not be attached. For me, as for me, I don't do this. Now get rid of that. That's all. I don't do that. Now you better don't imitate these things. That's why I don't speak about these things, you see. The conditioned mind can really imitate that and play games with the other. Very, I am keeping away from these things. I seldom talk about, speak about this. But you are such sweet things. Such a nice little group. So I can tell you little stories, but he's quite remarkable. He was a roller of cigarettes, was his profession. He wrote, he was always attending. And what?
The Shiva poor Baba too smoked.
Yeah? So, and he said he just did what the teacher said, observe, be witness. And very imperceptibly, my mind opened, he said. And suddenly it was not any more closing. I understand. It is really coming out of the horse's mouth, what he says.
Hmm.
He's about, I think, maybe 80 years old now. I spoke about that in, because someone knew it, heard of it, in Scheibs in Austria. Two students want already to go. They're already planning the journey to it. Yeah, so you see, but he does not teach. He doesn't give you any, he doesn't let you sit down like we do here and how you do it. He just is radiating his vibrations, and when there is a need, he will respond. Hmm? Yes, did you say something you want to say?
That the Shiva Prabhupada happened it several times to me, but I came thinking about a question,
mm-hmm.
and I went all the way from Svayambhunath to Kathmandu to him, about 1.5 hours on foot, for to be prepared. And when I came and settled down, he answered my question without, before I had asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I think he did my question too, answer, because
yes.
This be aware
he
of
saw awareness. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are so tuned
situation.
In. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's nice to talk about it, and I think it is good. You see, one of the, it's not of the 14 characteristics. I think in some other connection, it is said that it is good to be in the presence of wise people. One should see. And when you are, you should see it as an honor, as an honor to be with them. Not as an object for worship, but as an honor for you to be with them. So I felt that it was a great opportunity, a great fortune to be in the presence. But I was never late. The 4 weeks I went to him. After that, I didn't want to be asked again. Yeah.
You spoke about mirror, and I went with a Japanese to the Mount Everest for many years ago, and we had a lot of time in the evenings, and he told me there are Shinto shrines in Japan,
mm-hmm.
and they are like this matron in Tyrol, where you have such stations, you go from station to station,
mm-hmm.
on the hill, you worship some
crucifix. Oh, yes.
And so on.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in a similar way are some Shinto stations, ways
mm-hmm.
in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no image in this shrine, there is only a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
As you look, looks your God.
Hmm.
That means you look in the mirror, and as you look, looks your God. If you look horrible, your God looks also horrible inside.
Your God, yeah.
Because we, God is always a creation of ourselves. And
yeah.
Sege Jung says also, speaks about projection.
But you see,
make
I am very
of God and projected into the
mm-hmm.
universe.
But we have to be very careful with that language, to kind of bring it into to conditioned mind. For many, they are so lonely, so isolated, that the concept of God gives a great comfort, no matter
mm.
how it projected it is. You know, it. It gives comfort, and it gives an object for the mind. It's an is actually the symbol of a loving, pure state of being. And the concept of God gives the mind something to connect there, to create the bridge. It is otherwise too abstract and too painful and too isolated for the human being. So I feel kind of, you know, one has to be careful where you use it and how you see it. It's all very complicated and yet very simple. And it goes basically about the same thing. It concerns my life. It concerns my my natural striving toward happiness and my natural unfolding toward that. And we have to become, it's nice to become clear about the means you use for that, and it's even nicer to understand how you use the means and how you are in that process functioning. And the Buddha's teaching does give us this. And that is, so here you don't need the concept of God really, because you begin to understand it from the beginning with the right way and the right straight facts, factual way.
But for most people, it's Buddhism also too cool.
Yeah, it is. Very, very cool.
And Buddhism has never got great popularity.
No, but it was also...
Not from the beginning.
Okay. It's also because... It is because it's so much spoken about suffering. First Noble Truths, all suffering. Well, who wants to hear it? And those who did promote or tried to promote the Buddha's teachings into the Western world, mostly people who have not had realization deep enough of the and understanding through practice. They were mostly called intellectual scholars who were propagating the Buddhist teachings. When I, for example, in my studies of, in relative religion, was writing theses, I think, on Buddhism, Hinduism, compared these. Well, I didn't, at that time, I didn't know anything about Buddhism, the end of 50s. Well, I thought, what are they talking about? About suffering? Well, everyone knows that. You know, was it just a teaching to me at that time? It appeared so. Also, it was of something which gives you an ethical code and a line of rules, and which were so familiar. Actually, I compared them right to the Ten Commandments. I thought it's not much difference. Only they don't have a God, they're not so good at love.
No, there's not much difference.
Yeah. So you see, when you just read the words without the practice and without deeply having stepped into that process and without the mental training of right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration, you cannot get into the depths of all of these aspects. You're not going to understand what it is about. You don't even understand why a religion is at all there. Is it just to follow morality, a moral life? You see, then one is already suspicious. But he says, you have to really come to the experience of the deconditioned mind in order to really bring the teachings in such a way that the human being can take it as its own unfolding, as a natural unfolding, not as an imposed thing. And I think that's why they were they have succeeded through the careful observation of the teachers in Buddhism. That means teachers mostly say, got by careful observation of the teacher before, got somehow who could be recognized that he had a stream entrance or so, had a recognition, an experience of the river flowing into the big ocean. Then, because of that, the teaching could perpetuate itself in a very pure way. It didn't get distorted. I mean, that's what they really have done. That's why there was not necessary wars about the truth and God, like we in Christianity have done it. And in Buddhism it has not happened. So.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's about this talk about the new age and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And about solving the problems of the world. And as far as I understand, these four noble truths, they don't speak about solving the problems of the
world. Oh, they don't? Have you listened into the Fourth Noble Truth?
Yeah,
what it is saying?
I have seen it as a personal way to, well, help others and help myself.
No, I am following the Eightfold Path. You cannot say I'm not helping. You may not practice rightly. You may not understand it rightly yet. Give time. It needs a. You see, that is a very. You see, it's already a wrong question you are setting, actually. You want to solve your problems. You want to. Everything what you think you feel. Not really understanding the principle, we shall just observe. In the observing lays the solving, because there you have a deep, have it it well, it's hard to say. I am talking to so much about this all day long. Do I try to make you understand that the power of observation, the power of the alert mind, which is looking to the arising of maybe the depression or whatever you call your problem, if you can hold it in that and leave a little bit the desire out of solving it, right? Because the desire to solve makes the problem.
Mm.
You see? You tighten up here. You cannot do it with a desire. The desire's nature is to desire more.
Yes, but the suffering is there.
Well, then look at it. Just let it be in the space. Don't hold on to your depression. Don't hold on to your insisting mind. It should be this way and should be that way. When she is tiling the floor of the shower and she doesn't do it right, don't hold on to that. What annoys you? Look at it really. Whether she does it that wrong. So That is one obstacle, the desire to solve the problem. In training the mind, which is the three links in the Eightfold Path, number 6, 7, and 8, concentration, mindfulness, and right effort, that is the field in which we can train and solve the problems. Of course, supported by right conduct of life, supported by right speech of life, supported by the right livelihood. But in this field of mental training, there lays the solution of your problems. It, you see, the problem we have cannot be solved by changing the outer thing alone, the outer experience alone, the outer event. The outer event is just the expression already of your somehow doings and your attitudes before. So the solution lays in how you look at it and how you are viewing that. You are sad, it's a problem. You are depressed, it's a problem. Now how are you going to solve that? There's from the outside. It is an attitude. If I don't know whether I could demonstrate sometimes I think. The sadness and the depression is a mental force which is functioning in me. Can you see the smoke? You see? Now, you see it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a mental force. Now you see the mind here. Let's say that is a mind. Look at all the forms in here. There's depression, one wrinkle. Another one can be a pleasantness, another one can be attention, another one can be hatred or greed. All this is in the mind, you see, constantly changing. That's why we like incense, I think. Yeah, that is a representative. Some, one can maybe see it as that. Look at it. How it is, that is that fast. Consciousness is constantly changing. Constantly. The 52 mental factors are constantly rising and falling and holding on a little. You can still see it, but the minute it arises, it already has a different form and then another one. So that can be, let's say this is the whole field of mentality. There are these mental factors constantly arising and with some kind of already existing, which is the atmosphere. We can say that is the basic psychic consciousness, chitta it is actually called. And that connects itself, and then I have a consciousness which is depression, or which is sadness. Now, if you don't recognize this, that it has, that it is some mental factor in this whole mass, and which has the quality also to change and to pass out, then you are stuck. Then there is some that mental concept to which you have attached yourself. That is an I, and you are the one who suffers in depression now. Then you let this process just be totally by itself, and you insist now you are suffering with in depression. and don't allow to look at it, that it is in this constantly moving, and it, as it came into existence, it will move out of existence. It will somehow disappear here again. Then something else. And the, when you now have attention to it, you somehow have provided that there is a looking to this, a faculty of the mind which somehow realizes this anger, depression or sadness, mental factor, its nature is to move on, and basically there is no one here, this self, who really can hold on to it, because there is no self. It is the process which is functioning. So when you think, I am sad, you insist on something very totally wrong. It's a delusion. The right think, that's wrong view. That is one mental factor, wrong view. So you see, then you begin to, if you can realize it now, yeah, this is a process, constantly changing. Right now come up sadness. Well, you may just have time enough to look at it and say, why is this sadness there? Yeah, sure, because she was not putting the tiles right. Or she was very much flirting last night with somebody else. You see? So, but that already has passed. You can note it as it maybe it hurt you and your sadness. That is not that it is unreal in a way, it is. But that you are now insisting on it and let your whole day be ruled by this sadness instead of understanding it rightly. It's sadness, yeah. I understand that because of that and that. You may even go that far and say, look, yesterday you flirted too much. I feel a little sad about it. Maybe next time you think of it, you hurt my feeling. But in an open way, with a mind which is knowing it, we are in a process and we cannot kind of hold on and relate that in a very solid way. That can help tremendously. No one will take your sadness and your depression away. Even if you go to a psychiatrist, if he is in Freudian method, he will put you on the couch, you lay down, and what are you going to do? You have to talk about it by yourself. You are talking about it, not he. Till you finally realize what you are doing. And why you are holding on. It takes a year sometimes. Some just fortify the depression by talking about it. You see? But that could sound to some minds that it is really not a caring and that you are not really concerned. No, it isn't. It is just actually providing an atmosphere here that is seeing more objective and is not stopping the process, not insisting. It's hard to understand it for someone who is conditioned to feel sad all the time or to feel depressed. They have it so tight in that the depression has already become a sickness, a kind of a state of being, and is already cannot get out. And then I have to take pills, or I have to go to a psychiatrist, or whatever, you see. Sadness has its place, but our attachment to it, and we cannot see that it is an attachment. We mostly think it has done something to us, and I am having a problem. Very egotistic way to see that. That, of course, is hard to understand because we have not cultivated the mind in such a way that it is so sharp that it can see and live in this kind of process of and experience the constant changing and modulating of the pattern you are here. But maybe we are talking about far too high things. Just keep cool. Gerd, just keep cool and do your practice. And don't insist. The Eightfold Path does not help you. Do the mental training in it and train your mind to observe rightly what is arising. Then, after you have really deeply experienced, then you can say, maybe it doesn't help. And then you couldn't say that, you see. So it's just an expression of not having really trained finely enough the mind yet. And so as you remember the 14 characteristics, hold to the rules, hold to the prescriptions, so to speak, hold to the guidance. Perfect and widen your heart in these 14 characteristics, widen your efforts toward attention, toward concentration, toward being the witness to all what this figure, this form, Gerd, is experiencing. And in that, you see, when we watch something outside, you see, you watch a little baby or a child just walking, you watch it now, you don't help, you watch. You're not involved, but you watch. Immediately you will know when you have to help. When you don't watch, you will forget. Like a friend of mine and a nice Vipassana student, he forgot the child which walked, just enjoyed himself to walk. And she found him later in the bottom of the swimming pool. You see, that's forgetting. So, but if she had really watched, she would have been able to then you have the energies there to cut in and to redirect and to do the right thing. Or you can also, you can very carefully know when you help and when you don't help. What you have to do is actually saying in the light of your attention. In the same way, if I constantly notice my experiences, and the experience is hate, depression, worry, jealousy, envy, and so on. Or the experience is courage, trust, lovingness. This is also experiencing, which means types of consciousness. If you observe them and let them come up, like the baby, the child walking there, and you are present and see how you move, and even on the outer, you know. You are so alert, and you know what to do. You see the depression, you see the sadness or the jealousy for what it is. What is jealousy? It's a feeling. It's a reaction. It's a mental factor within our here in that mass of mind, which now wants to it's a negative form, which wants to form its consciousness and wants to penetrate you, wants to make an I, a big me, feeling very jealous. The process cannot do that. The process realizing it says it's a mental factor coming up now. Watch out how it moves. The attention will let it move in such a way that it finds the order in that process and cannot rule it. But when you put it to an I, then it makes it strong. See? And then you rule, are ruled by it. So the attention, then you can see more. You can even allow yourself a few thoughts to it. Because you really attend. Yeah, jealousy. Hmm. What does it really mean? Hmm. Aha. Yeah, sure. It's a feeling. Am I jealous that I looked? Actually, was nothing happening. She just talked nicely to that guy. But I didn't like it. She was too happy that moment when she talks with me. She isn't so open. See? A reaction. You really mean by jealousy, I don't want you to be happy. That you can see it that way. Of course, now it's another way. If she went secretly out, she meets secretly somebody, and that's a different thing, you see. Then you see it for what it is. Ah, yeah, sure. That really hurts. She's unfaithful. Actually, she's committed to me. Mm-hmm. Well, then you kind of see that. You see your position. Jealousy now is actually the fear of losing her. You see?
Mm.
Something else. You must see yourself. You must also see, what are you going to do now? Take a gun and shoot her? Wouldn't be so good. People do that too. They don't know what they do. So you can now, you be quiet, you are observing, you are jealous, you know what it is, you feel hurt. Now you can deal better with it. Okay, you talk to her. Then if you want to talk in awareness and an observation, you don't get angry. You don't push and don't throw things. You just plainly state you are hurt. And you can also say, well, look, I am really kind of not strong enough to see that because I fear I lose you. Yeah. Well, that is one level. On that level, most people don't operate. They just are very accusative, very much blaming the other, and so on. You must keep in also the discussion in in the light of your attention. Never lose it, at least at times. Remember that you are discussing that. Keep cool. Attention is not grabbing, is not judging, is not making it bad. Attention is just seeing for what it is. Jealousy, I'm not strong enough, I am have fear of losing. Well, and if you find out she really likes that other guy and you are have to face that, well, then you see you are losing. Life is also losing. Well, you may go to a counselor. I don't know if it's roommate counseling or marriage counseling or so, if you want to stay together. There are lots of ways. The main thing is that you do it in a human way, with attention, with the eightfold path, with the right effort, with the right... don't push it into an I all the time. Sure, I am unhappy, I am having the fear. But see it also how it kind of is a process at the same time. And when you are losing attention, then you lose the kind of understanding of that. Then the jealousy and your feeling will be dominant, so strong that it puts shadow over the entire process. And you are cut off from the rest of your livingness. And there is a big I put before, and to which you have attached, or you have put the jealousy. Now, this is one way of seeing it. It's hard. It's a hard way. Where you can help yourself, you talk about it a little, but always keep your attention. You go to a good friend, and you may speak to a wise person about it. You must see the situation, what you can save in that. But sometimes you cannot save it. Then you just let it go. Then there is a different flow of that river, of yours and the other. But don't let it go in that what I'm... This letting go is also wrong to understand. Don't let it go, I don't care, I'm the hell with you, you are jealous, I don't want you. No, no, it's a middle path, always, with understanding, with respect, with your human good qualities, not with the nasty ones. So, one could, we could talk for ultimo about these things. You don't solve them. We can only kind of see some aspects of it, what is involved. But no one can take away that jealousy. No one can tear you away from that attachment. And then also see that we really somehow are neurotically attached or neurotically identified with our pains. The jealousy and the depression is an insisting on it, and having yourself having given so much unconsciously force for this depression or this frustration or this jealousy, that it nothing is now of that living process any more possible. Accept this depression, and you have to have help all around. This pills and that, and doctors will say, oh, you are manic depressive, and you are this, and you are that, and you are split personality, you are schizophrenic, and all kinds of names you get. Then you're not really insulted for that. Because you are kind of now manic depressive. There's nothing else there. You cannot relate to anything anymore. And then that is identification. Then you have an I established, and put your that state of mind to the I, and everything else is not living. Is a contracted state of being. You cannot love anymore. You cannot help anymore. You cannot relate to other beings. You are just like little baby on the breast of the mother, sucking from other people's energy and help. If you could see yourself that when you are manic depressive, or you are jealous or whatever, you would just drop it. You would be scared, ashamed. But you see, you cannot just also do it. Because in such extreme identification with the I, you don't have the faculty of the mind anymore to see it, to recognize it. So you need all this help from outside. You need the mental hospital, you need the psychiatrist, you need loving people around you, and you start all over again.
You have to build it up.
What?
Would you have to build it up gradually?
What?
You have to build it up.
So then you have to give the help you get, and but you see, it will then depend also on the kind of help. But wherever it might happen, that it softens, and that somehow from all the helps, no matter, mostly they are wrong, because they are ignorant also. You know, it's just ignorance on top of ignorance. He has fun, he loves fun. You can see the whole platter of ignorance and of creating suffering. I talked about the First Noble Truth very, very poorly. Just a few points I can talk. When I just have to give a systematic account, it's very poor, because it's just not the whole thing. You have to really start into the digging into the process, and then through that you can see it a little bit. So now where was I? Where did I stop?
But is it not wonderful? The person must become very happy because it becomes so important by all these diseases.
Well, yeah, that is sure. But we are that I mentioned. But we are already now saying that, you see, no matter how important he feels and all what is identified, the fact is that he does not have the faculty to get out of it. The mind is clever to get you into these traps. Very clever. Comes in roses and in beautiful embroidery and in luring and attention and in dance and and another drink and let's live up and just tonight and so on. Wonderful. And you just, you know, it comes in all ways. The mind is very clever. And it can only be experienced through walking the way of the fourth noble truth, or the guideline. So the first one realized, the second, the cause understood, the third has to be experienced, and the fourth has to be walked. And realize that we have to do this. The Buddha was enlightened. He saw everything. But his enlightenment does not solve our ignorance and our problems. We have to go into this process and do it by ourselves. And follow the invitation he gives us, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. These Four Noble Truths, when you begin to study or to read a little about Buddhism or the scriptures of the Buddha, they appear again and again and again. They are actually the heart of the of Buddhism. They are the core of it. All other things we are reading are only the explanations. So I think that is enough. We could talk a lot more about these. Sometimes I take time to talk only about one of the truths the whole evening. But I think because our time runs out in a short way, I tried to, in a shorter way, to give you an idea of the content of each of these truths. Perhaps we could see them as a sequence, as a unit of four different of sequences, and one is leading to the other. It isn't just the First Noble Truth and the Third Noble Truth. It is a completed unit. That is to say, you could not add a fifth one, or you could take one out. Why? Because the first one is saying the condition, describing and telling us the facts of life, dukkha. The second is telling us plainly the cause of this dukkha, the cause, the next sequence. The third says, there is an out of it. And the fourth is now saying, you have a guidance for this. Here is the way how to do it. Now that is why we couldn't have a fifth one. It's not necessary anymore. These four are giving the complete, is a complete unit. You see? So perhaps you have a question. Yes, Richard.
One of the Buddhist truths is about anicca, that all things change.
Yeah, well, that is suffering. That's the first noble truth.
And
belongs to the first noble one, because change is also a cause for the suffering. Change is suffering. The change, the impermanence is suffering.
But is
you can see, yeah, that appears in a different. Let's see. You can explain it in a different way, the Buddha's teaching. That it, no, that's not anymore the teaching. It's maybe we can see it as the three essentials of the Buddha's teaching. He taught of impermanence, he taught of suffering, and he taught the law of no self. You see, but all are actually, all what it is saying is, because it's a condition, and because of that, they are suffering.
But my actual question, I have not put yet.
Okay.
That,
you haven't? Well, why don't you?
Because I wait.
Good.
How can the state of nirvana be also not subject for change?
Because it is the end of suffering.
But then everything is not changing.
Oh yes, it is still changing. Only your mind isn't changing anymore. You are steadying, receiving all the events. You see so clear, constantly change, arising and falling out of existence. And what sees and what is viewing it is constant. That is the nibbanic mind. You see?
What about the four truths?
That
they don't change either.
Say it again.
About the four noble truths.
The last one.
Do they change one?
They are just the fourth one. Yeah, they are also subject to change. They are actually a description. The number one is a description of the condition. The condition constantly changes. Yes.
But not the truth.
No.
Because then it could be different.
Yeah, the truth does not, and the truth is actually the seeing of that. The mind, which is so steady in understanding that, is so steady of clearly seeing that there is nothing but change. Each second is a consciousness arising. Each moment, millions of thoughts are running through. On the material world, constantly change is occurring. arising and passing away. Eyes constantly see change. Everything changes. So it is not that the outside is steady in the nibbanic state. That is a change. All phenomena are subject to change. That means they also, the destructiveness is in them. Out of that, something else will develop.
But
the mind which sees that, and the body which is experiencing the change, actually it's out of that, is steady. That consciousness which is receiving these messages and seeing the condition, seeing the cause, is no subject to change. It is a white mind which has transcended and it's broken through that mind which is working through the senses, through the identification of I. It's hard to understand that. Very hard. Yes, Sugata.
I have got the explanation that nirvana is the unification with the absolute. That means the returning of the I to the God.
That is in a Christian term. Very good said, yeah.
And a Brahmin, a very old Brahmin, spoke with me once, and in the middle of one setting he mm-hmm. was putting in something, and he said, look, a river has a name and shore and direction.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes to the sea, he loses shore and name and direction, and that is nirvana.
Mm.
That is, in other mm-hmm. words, we lose the Gebundenheit, what is this in English?
Limitation
by space and time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are always bound by mm-hmm. space and time, but when we lose this limitation by space and time, then we come, then is nirvana reached. The ego, the personality disappears completely.
Yeah, but it really has no value in too much thinking about it, because the conditioned mind can really not grasp it, and can just build another condition with it. I think just keeping open the mind, which is not clinging to the experiences, and is constant and training itself constantly to be alert and to be witness of the arising and the passing away of events, of feelings, of consciousness, of depression, of my ideas, of my all forms of suffering. All forms of unfolding. You are a kind of imitating or putting efforts a little toward the little enlightened mind. Because that is the quality of it, that it doesn't react, that it doesn't have any connection, what you said, attachment to I. It is just in great alertness and recognizing always what is happening. Now that sounds very frightening for some conditioned mind, because they say, well, then I don't experience anything more, I cannot feel any, and I cannot care anymore, and just shall be detached from everything. That's not so. You see, if you can observe in very an alertness, where you have no ideas of, or you are filled with your own feelings, you are with an open mind and open heart looking at what is happening, you are free actually to really participate if you needed to participate. You are also free to decide now rightly whether you want to participate in that event, whether you want to become repressed and sad when the sadness is arising, or you have, and you, or you have the choice to really to say no, to let it pass by. It is, it's subject to impermanence. It will change. And in the strength and in the acceptance and in the non-involvement of your observing mind, it changes, it vibrates what is there, the depression, the sadness, the greed, the hate, and before you know, you are free from it again.